Welcome to The Authentic Woman. This is your host, Shannon Fisher, my 50th show on the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. So I am excited to kind of have this anniversary, and we're going to talk about a very important topic from a different angle than maybe we've discussed before. My guest is Dr. Jim Hopper, and he is an instructor in psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. He's done significant research in the neurobiology of trauma, and I first came across him when I read a piece that he wrote for the Washington Post about why many rape victims don't fight or yell, and I just thought this is someone whose brain I want to tap. And so today we're going to talk about what happens during different traumatic situations and the effect of different kinds of trauma on the brain. So without further ado, I would like to welcome Dr. Jim Hopper. Jim, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Shannon. I really appreciate it.
Well, sure. I was very moved when I read your Washington Post piece. And I will share a link to it in the broadcast page. So if you're listening on the BTR site, you can see a link. Otherwise, Why Many Rape Victims Don't Fight or Yell is the title. Victim blaming is out of control, and people who have been sexually assaulted are constantly questioned with, why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do that? Why didn't you run? Why didn't you yell? And it was so nice to see something from a scientific perspective really explaining that. So what was it that inspired you to write that piece?
Well, I've been teaching about this for a while, and I really thought it could be helpful if I could try to, in a very focused way, hit the key points for a broad audience so that it would be something that could be read by anybody, police officers, legislators, people who've been through this themselves, their friends, their partners. So I really wanted to write something that would be, you know, as accessible and short as possible for a lot of people.
Yes.
The blame is often people blaming themselves. And so I really also wrote this for people who may be confused about why their bodies seem to betray them and not respond in a way that they would think it should have. Those are the most important audience, really, people who have been through this, and to just reassure them that this is just how brains work under attack. And we evolved to have our brains respond in this way. And it's nothing to be ashamed of or to blame yourself about it. It's not just women and men and sexual assault. It could be a soldier. It could be a police officer involved in a shooting. This is just the brain on fear.
And you talk about how the military is often trained to kind of circumvent the fight or flight syndrome, but the average person certainly doesn't. So tell me a little bit about the neurobiological chemical process that does happen when someone, say, freezes.
So there's a few things that we can touch on here from what you just asked. One is this: even the idea of fight or flight can cause confusion, actually. I try not to hit people with too many different brain regions and trying to keep track of all that. I ground it in the science, but I talk about just some key circuitries of our brain. And the most important circuitry when we're thinking about how people respond when they're assaulted or when they're terrified is the circuitry of fear. We can't understand how people respond in a situation where they are under attack or in combat or something like that without understanding how the circuitry of fear comes to basically take over the brain. Our fear circuitry is always on. Right now, our fear circuitry is monitoring the external and internal environment for signs of danger, for signs of things that aren't expected, for evidence that there might be something that could hurt us. And so it's always on, scanning the environment automatically outside of our awareness. But when it detects that an attack is underway, then it completely shifts into high gear and it starts to change the way other parts of our brain operate. And one of the most important things it does is within a couple of seconds, it releases some stress chemicals, we could call them, that impair what we call the prefrontal cortex. That's the part of our brain behind our forehead, above our eyes, that allows us to think rationally, that allows us to use our higher, what we call executive capacities, to be able to focus our attention where it makes sense to focus our attention based on, you know, trying to deal with a situation or solve a problem. But when the fear kicks in, that area of our brain becomes impaired very rapidly. And then what we pay attention to, and which of course relates to what we remember later, is driven by the circuitry of fear. And it could be zeroing in on just like a snarl on the guy's face. It could be zeroing in on a little spot on the wall as someone's trying to escape from the horrible sensations in their body. And so right away, just understanding that there's these two key circuitries, the circuitry of fear and this prefrontal circuitry, we can understand that the fear circuitry takes over It impairs the prefrontal cortex, and we're no longer a rational being who can think things through and focus on what would make sense to focus on or what the investigator wishes we had noticed later. It's just fear taking over, impairing our logical, rational brain, and our attention is just grabbing onto things that seem like they're a matter of survival. That can affect memory because, let's face it, you know, if we're not paying attention to something, we're not encoding it into memory.
Right. Now, so what kinds of trauma make this circuitry of fear kind of go into effect? What different things that happen to humans in life, aside from a sexual assault, what are other things that would cause this to happen?
There are, you know, many different kinds of violence, of course, that can cause it to happen. So, you know, a kid being beat up on the playground, a kid having a parent, an angry, enraged parent screaming in their face, a parent watching their kid run into the street and get hit by a car or even almost get hit by a car. You know, as part of being human, we've all had experiences where we've been in a situation where suddenly something happened and there was a surge of adrenaline in our body and in our brain, it was impairing our ability to think straight or think clearly. And so there's so many examples of violence, of accidents. It could be a car accident. It could be a whole variety of things. And so, you know, listeners can think of times in their own lives when something's happened. And sometimes it's only just, it seemed like something terrible was about to happen, and their brain goes into this mode. You know, someone told me about a situation where she was hanging out with her sister in her the bedroom of her apartment. They were getting ready to go out that night, thinking about who they were going to see, what they were going to do, and then they heard a noise in the living room. And they both thought there was an intruder in the living room. And her sister says to her, call 911. And she says, what's the number? Like, wow. How prepared is your brain if someone says, call 911, and you go, what's the number?
Right.
You're obviously not thinking clearly, and you can't even figure that out. So, you know, there's just so many examples. And so it can even be a misperception of something that terrifies you. But once that fear kicks in, and the more afraid you are, the more impairment it's going to cause of your rational thinking brain.
So what about people who have anxiety disorders, who feel anxiety on a daily basis without necessarily having a stimulus? Does that factor into the equation as far as that concerns?
Yeah, so these things are kind of on a continuum. So the research on the effects of these chemicals on the brain looks at fear, but it also looks at stressful situations, and that can include anxious situations where people are anticipating bad things happen or happening to them or worrying a lot. So it's on a continuum, and the more anxious someone is, the more they're likely to have these chemicals hitting their prefrontal cortex. Now, some anxiety, right? Sometimes if we're too chill about something, if we've got something important we're going to do, we're going to give a speech somewhere, or we got some important, you know, meeting that we got to be able to present at, or something like that. You know, some anxiety can actually, you know, pump some of those chemicals into our prefrontal cortex and help it work a little better. If we're too chill about it, then maybe we're not going to really be on our game. But if the anxiety gets too high, and, you know, again, as human beings, most of us have experienced this, right?
Sure.
We've had situations where we felt really anxious, and then we weren't able to remember what we meant to say or what we were supposed to say or to pay attention to the things we knew we were supposed to pay attention to and all that, because we didn't have as well a functioning of a prefrontal cortex to allow us to remember the important things, to think things through, to keep focused on, you know, what our goals were for the situation. So anxiety, a little bit of anxiety can help us in certain situations, but the more anxiety it is, the more stress, all the way up into fear and terror, the more impairment there's going to be.
Sure.
And when I say impairment, you know, it's impairment on the one hand, like if you're in a meeting and you're trying to present something, but these are all evolved responses of our brain. You know, we evolved as prey, you know, lions, tigers, there's a lot of other bigger animals that could take us out for thousands and thousands of years. And if you go further back into evolution, you know, you think where we came from, you know, when we were really small animals before we became human, you know, there were lots of animals that could take us out. And so we evolved to, when a threat or an attack is detected, to have basic reflexive responses that our brain can automatically fall back on. Because if you stop to think, you're lunch for some other animal. You know, it was adaptive in surviving, but, you know, it can also be, you know, quite maladaptive, of course, if you're overly freaking out about some meeting or you get, you know, totally overwhelmed in the midst of an assault and you can't actually think through, you know, how you might be able to respond. Actually, the door is open and you could go for it. There's people next door who you might yell out to. But when your prefrontal cortex is impaired, those things don't occur to you. And it's not because you're stupid. It's just because that's what fear does to the brain. And, you know, if it was a tiger attacking you, that might help you survive. But in an assault, you know, it may actually help you survive an assault too, but it may, you know, leave you more vulnerable.
Right. Now, is there a difference in the response between adults and children?
There are differences, but, you know, children are smaller. I mean, they're more likely to be more afraid by, mm-hmm. by things because they are so much more vulnerable. But it's still the same brain being affected by fear. You know, there's research on children's memories. You know, I talked a little bit about memory, but there's also things about how fear changes the functioning of an area called the hippocampus, which is the part of our brain that allows us to encode and then store away experiences that we're having. And the fear circuitry definitely has big effects on the hippocampus and how it functions. And then in children, depending on how old they are, there's differences in hippocampus function, you know, in different stages of childhood. Before age 5, for example, it's hard for the hippocampus to really encode things in a way that we're going to be able to retrieve them, you know, a long time in the future. That's why most of us don't remember much before we were age 5, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that sort of thing, you know, and there's very good interviewing protocols that have been developed to deal with the nature of children's memories and how to interview children about being sexually abused or physically abused in age-appropriate ways that are keyed to how their memory circuitry has developed to that point and what its capabilities are. So I think the memory circuitry is really the biggest difference for kids versus adults. But in terms of if a kid is being attacked or if an adult is being attacked, the basics of the fear circuitry, detecting the attack, going into high gear, impairing the prefrontal cortex, altering how the memory circuitry works, all that stuff is the same.
Okay. And speaking of childhood sexual abuse, I know you've done some studies and some work on awareness of the abuse of boys, because I think there's so much focused on the abuse of young girls and adult women that we tend to forget that 1 in 6 men has had an unwanted or abusive sexual experience. So tell me, what kinds of awareness are you working to bring toward that, and is there a difference in response between a man and a woman?
So, yeah, there's a lot in there, and it's true. 1 in 6, and that may even be a conservative estimate for boys who have had unwanted sexual experiences, abusive sexual experiences. I also want to say, though, that, you know, that those statistics include people who may have had one experience, and then they may have been believed and supported by their parents. So that doesn't mean necessarily that 1 in 6 guys are, like, severely harmed. But if they have a loving, helpful, supportive response, there doesn't have to be long-term major harm.
Right.
And so child sexual abuse tends to be different than adult sexual assault in that most of it involves what we call grooming. And this is where the perpetrator goes through a very gradual, slow process to get the kid to the point that when the abuse is happening, there's not fear kicking in very much because they've broken down the defenses. They've befriended the kid. They're giving him candy. They're taking him to football games with their Jerry Sandusky. You know, they're doing these different things to try and gradually, like, you know, putting a frog in the proverbial boiling water, right? They're trying to gradually get the kid to where the kid will maybe feel weird and freaked out by it a little bit, but not terrified that this person is doing these things to their body.
Yeah.
So we want to think about, you know, child sexual abuse versus adult sexual assault. That's a key component, is most of the child sexual abuse, not all of it, but most of it, is they're slowly groomed and their defenses are broken down, so they're not terrified when it happens. In terms of the different responses, I mean, I would say there's a lot of the same responses, of course, right? It's terrible to be exploited and manipulated and betrayed by someone you thought you could trust. It's terrible to be used as an object for someone else's pleasure, someone who has more power than you, has more knowledge of how the world works and is just using you in that way. Those have negative effects on everybody, male or female. There's a lot of shame that people feel after this because it, you know, the way they were treated, to be made to keep some secret. Mm-hmm. And there's so much betrayal involved, it can lead to people not trusting people, being afraid of intimate relationships, being afraid of being hurt again if they let down their guard and make themselves vulnerable to people. But for boys, there's kind of this additional aspect of boys are not supposed to be victims. Boys are not supposed to be vulnerable. When it comes to the realm of sexuality, you know, males are supposed to be the aggressors, not the ones who were dominated or victimized. And so sexual abuse of boys completely flies in the face of what it is to be masculine, or images of masculinity, not only in terms of the experience of the abuse itself, But then the emotions that it saddles you with, the fear, the shame, the vulnerable emotions, you know, men aren't supposed to feel those vulnerable. Men are supposed to be strong, tough, you know, anger's our go-to if something's not going well. For men, it can really cause a lot of problems with their sense of their masculinity and lead them to feel like if other people really knew, they'd know they're really not a real man. And, you know, and sometimes guys will go to great lengths to try to prove their manhood, and they're trying to overcome this inner sense that because this happened to them, they're not a real man.
I understand there's sexual assault in the military against men and women is rampant, and I imagine that really wreaks havoc in the brain of especially a soldier who essentially their job is associated with their masculinity and their power.
Yeah, and I just want to say, too, though, you know, it's not just the military, of course. It's in higher education. It's in communities outside of that. But, yes, the military has been grappling with this, and military culture is a place, you know, it is a masculine, even hyper-masculine culture, a warrior culture, and to be sexually assaulted in that environment can be very devastating because it completely goes against the identity of a soldier, of a Marine, for example. And also, you know, some guys, part of their experience of going into the military, I mean, sadly, you know, we talked about 1 in 6, you know, men have been sexually abused. Physical abuse in childhood saddles guys with vulnerable emotions that they want to block themselves off from, extreme emotional abuse. And this is very high prevalence in our culture of abuse of children, sadly.
Yeah.
We don't want to think about it. We don't want to know about it. We don't devote enough resources to it. But it's there. There's a lot of abuse in all classes, races, religions. And so a lot of guys going into the military, they've been through abuse as kids. They have this vulnerable, hurt part of them that they try to protect themselves from, and one of the ways is by grasping on to, you know, the strong aspects of masculinity and that kind of hyper-macho sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. And they go into the military, and the military provides them with a place where they can be successful and have a good career and really become the strong man that they always wanted to be. But then if they get sexually assaulted in that environment, it's like suddenly all that is shattered. And all the vulnerability and hurt from their childhood, all that comes rushing back. And so it can be particularly devastating to someone in the military who may feel like finally they achieve that masculinity, that strong manhood that they always wanted from when they were a little kid, only to have it ripped away from them again by being assaulted that way in the military.
And what about the flip side of that? What about the perpetrators? I know that there's the cycle of abuse that a lot of men and women who have been abused end up becoming the abuser. How does that factor into the equation?
You know, this was something I really focused on in graduate school and did my master's research and my dissertation research on this, you know, how it is that boys who are abused as boys, how when they grow up, how they can become, you know, abusers of others. One of the most important things I want to say is, while it is true that most perpetrators of violence have been victims of violence themselves, most people who are victimized as children do not go on to abuse others. There's a myth sometimes, especially about boys and men, that if you were abused, that you're going to go on to abuse other people. And that's not true. Most don't. Are they at higher risk? Yes, they are. For some of the same reasons I talked about before, how, you know, people want to protect themselves from these vulnerable hurt parts of themselves. And one of the ways they do that is they kind of latch onto these strong and sometimes aggressive parts of themselves. And people sometimes see the world in this dichotomous way, like either you're a victim or you're a perpetrator. Either you're one of the strong or you're one of the weak. And I've been through that. I've been on the other side. I'm going to be strong. I'm going to take what I want. You know, you can't trust anybody, that sort of stuff. So some of that stuff can play into it. But for boys and men, a lot of it is just that the way we're socialized to deal with our feelings is that over and over again we get messages from all angles that it's not okay to be vulnerable, it's not okay to feel or express sadness, shame, fear, any of these things that come with being abused. And so in some ways masculine gender socialization is even more destructive than abuse. Because if you get abuse, in some ways it can sensitize you. It's, you know, I wouldn't wish it on anyone, but people who've been abused, if they have supportive people around them, they can actually know what it's like to be really vulnerable and be hurt by someone else. And that can be an avenue for empathy and compassion and never wanting to do it again and even wanting to help others who've been through this. Mm-hmm. But on masculine gender socialization, for the most part, is conditioning men to just try and push that vulnerable stuff away, push it away, push it away, push it away. And here, you know, have some anger, have some power trip, macho stuff. Why don't you grab onto that and run with that? And that increases the risk that guys are going to perpetrate. And I'm not trashing all aspects of masculinity. You know, masculinity involves some things that are good human things. But to the extent that people are being raised as boys and men to block out, push away, crush these vulnerable parts of them, then they're much more likely to hurt other people.
Sure. Now, do you have any ideas about how our society can curtail that masculine gender socialization? I mean, it really is everywhere.
Well, you know, these are big, big problems.
Yeah.
I think that acknowledging the extent of abuse of children, both boys and girls, and recognizing the consequences that has on people's minds and bodies, you know, the way that can contribute to addiction, to anxiety disorders, depression, all kinds of things. Just acknowledging the abuse that people go through as kids and how that's something really important to deal with. And then especially, you know, not neglecting boys who have been through this. I think to the extent that we can show that being vulnerable and being hurt is unfortunately part of a lot of people's experience, and that boys go through this too, and it's a source of strength to be able to actually, with the right support, to face your suffering, to face your pain, and to transform that into something good, that this is a kind of strength and power. Guys are still going to absorb some of the stuff. They're going to want to be strong men and everything, but we can help boys and men understand strength in a different way, that strength and power come from being able to deal with vulnerability and not having to just run away from them by being a tough guy. Being a strong person and being a tough guy are not the same thing. And so I think there's a lot that can be done, and a lot of people are working on this. And I know around the Super Bowl, there's some campaign going on talking about, you know, model men and what does it mean to be a good, strong man. And so there's a lot that can be done, you know, through athletic programs, through school programs, through public policy that really acknowledges the extent of abuse and trauma of girls and boys. And when we're looking at how to help boys through it, how to help them think of it, realize that they can be a real boy and a real man who happens to have had these kind of experiences, and that they can be a very powerful person, more powerful and more strong, if they're able to actually acknowledge these experiences and the pain. It doesn't mean they have to go shout it from the rooftops, or they have to, you know, be like Mr. Therapy or recovery or anything like that. I'm not saying that, but just be able to, you know, in whatever way works for them, acknowledge that this is part of their life, and that be able to deal with those feelings is a real form of power. What men are often doing under the guise of being strong and powerful, they're actually running in fear from their vulnerability. You know, a lot of people have religious faith and religious experiences, and I think, you know, religion and the values of religion, you know, if we think of religious figures that people admire and try to connect to, Jesus, Buddha, Muhammad, you know, these are men too, right? And they're powerful men, but they're loving men and wise men. And I think a lot of people, through their religious experience and organization and support, that can be a real avenue for transforming people's experience of their masculinity. So I just want to say that too. It's not all about, you know, public policy and therapy and things like that. There's a lot wonderful institutions of religion that people are still connected to can be part of that process.
That's a very good point. Those are definitely loving, positive, wonderful role models for people. For those who haven't had access to any kind of therapy or any sort of coping tools, you mentioned that these kinds of experiences in childhood turn into depression, anxiety, and even addiction as an adult. So tell me a little bit about that process and how addiction develops from these kinds of traumas.
In terms of addiction and the suffering that people have in the aftermath of this, I mean, one, you know, simple but compelling way to understand it is that we all have, you know, I talked about a circuitry of fear. We all have this circuitry of fear that is always looking for things that are potentially going to hurt us and are scary. And that can be things inside, right? It's not just about people attacking us on the outside. It could be bad memories. It could be shameful feelings about things we've been through in our past. Those are scary things too. Those are things we want to push away. And there's another fundamental circuitry of the human brain, which is one of the best studied circuitries. It's the circuitry of seeking. The circuitry that seeks to, you know, scratch that itch so it goes away, that seeks to be a successful, you know, broadcaster, that seeks to be a successful businessman, to be a good mother, to be whatever, anything we want, anything we're seeking out, from a crack high to, you know, connection with Jesus at a brain level. And I'm not reducing everything. I'm not saying, oh, it's just, you know, it's just neurons firing. But to the extent that we do have bodies and brains, there's a circuitry of our brain called the seeking circuitry that's part of, people might have heard of the reward circuitry. This is a part of that. And that circuitry is always on, and it's always seeking things. And what happens in the aftermath of trauma, and all of us, to some extent, we have suffering in our lives, and we seek to escape from it. You know, it's not fun to hang out in states of depression and shame and anxiety and all that. We seek to get away from that. But unfortunately, what happens so much is that the ways we seek to escape from our suffering only perpetuate it. You know, we're seeking these quick fixes. Oh, if I just, you know, get a new iPhone, if I just get a raise at work. I'm not saying these are bad things to seek out, but if our seeking is caught up so much with things that are not really relieving our suffering, they're just giving us escapes from it, then we're very vulnerable to seeking out things that can be very addictive and destructive. And so this is a lot of what addiction is. It's people seeking from seeking escape from unwanted things and doing it in ways that, yeah, they give them temporary relief. It can feel really good to get high on crack. It can feel really good to spend a couple hours surfing internet porn. You know, people feel guilty about it too, but in the moment they're doing it for a reason, right?
Right.
It can feel good to eat a huge, you know, meal that's way bigger than you need. There's all kinds of things people can get addicted to: gambling, sex, power. But it's not really satisfying us, and it's not really healing the suffering that we're trying to escape from. So I think that's, you know, for me, that's like the most basic way to understand addiction, is that that circuitry of seeking is getting caught up in just trying to escape from the bad stuff. And what good therapy and powerful, you know, religious fellowship and experiences is, it's about taking that seeking circuitry and helping people turn toward their suffering in safe ways that are transformative. And then also just to not just seek out stuff that's not really that satisfying, like the latest tech toy or something like that, but to seek out the really good things in life. Love, play, freedom, contributing to our community. So I think that their seeking gets caught up in things that may be helping them escape in the short term, but cause a lot of suffering. And there's tools out there, and there's supportive networks of people in AA and in religious communities and in therapy who can help them seek to deal with their suffering and seek out things that are really going to be satisfying, so they're going to be much less attracted to those quick fixes and addictive things.
So what does turning toward your suffering look like? What, if someone is seeking an escape and really trying to suppress something internally, memories that are causing them strife on a daily basis, turning toward the suffering, how does that transform that experience?
Well, just, you know, what does it look like first? You know, that can be a scary thought for people, right? Like, no way I want to turn toward, you know, I'm trying to forget about this stuff. That's going to overwhelm me. That's going to destroy me if I turn around to face that stuff. That's a real fear people have. In the field of psychological trauma, you know, people talk about what we call stage-oriented treatment. And the first stage is not just like, okay, I'm going to delve into those worst memories of being sexually abused by my stepfather. No, it's not that at all. The first stage is getting the support and the skills and the resources just to be able to deal with the things that are causing you the most problems right now. So if you're really tormented by memories, how can you learn how to maybe block those out a little better for now?
Mm-hmm.
How can you develop the tools to be able to handle your emotions and memories? You know, we might call them, you know, emotion regulation skills. You know, there's a lot of therapeutic interventions that help people gain these skills. Only once you're feeling safer in your body and you feel like you have the skills and the support to deal with the bad stuff, then that's the second stage of trauma treatment. Then you turn toward, if you choose, you know, no one's going to force you to do this, you may choose to start delving into some of those memories and the pain and the shame and the feelings of betrayal and abandonment by your family when that was going on. But so it's not just like, okay, you're going to dive into the bad stuff. It's a gradual process, done at a pace that works for you. You're in the driver's seat. The therapist is there to help you, but they're there to help you get some skills and tools and support so that if and when you're ready to really turn toward the more difficult parts of that, that you can then turn toward those memories and you can experience them in a safe, therapeutic environment. And yeah, you may cry. Yes, you may feel profound sadness, but you will discover that you're stronger than you thought you were. And you can actually transform those memories into, you know, bad memories, sad memories, but not things that are torturing you, not things that you need to run away from and seek escapes and addictive sort of things. You know, acknowledge it as part of your life and accept it and keep moving forward.
Sure. And I think for children and for women, it's a lot easier to admit that they're suffering. But thinking of, you know, the veterans who are suffering PTSD from having been in combat, and there's so much of that going on right now, who, because of that gender socialization, don't want to admit that they're suffering and don't want to turn to get some help. So if there's anybody out there listening who feels that it's a sign of weakness to turn to get help, what would you say to them?
You know, I would say that I totally understand why you feel that way, and it can make you vulnerable in certain ways. You know, in the military context, it's definitely true that there's still blind spots, and especially from some of the older, more senior people who are from a different era, it can be seen as a weakness. So I don't want to deny the validity of those concerns, but I also want to say that there are people in the VA system and elsewhere who get it and who can help you deal with this stuff, again, at your own pace, and help you find the strength to deal with this. There are people. Don't give up if the first ones don't work.
And what about the families of those people? How can families and friends of both of military PTSD or, you know, the police or childhood sexual abuse or adult rape victims, how can the support system, the social support system, contribute to the healing of victims who have been through trauma?
Well, you know, we could spend hours on that, but on all this stuff, really.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things I say to people, and a lot of people contact me, people find me on the internet and contact me about a spouse or a child who's going through a lot, you know, an adult, a grown-up child. And some of the things I always say are that, one, they're lucky to have you caring about them and looking for ways to help them. But it's really important to get support for yourself, because it can be very, very difficult to try to support and help someone through this. You don't have to call it therapy. You can call it consultation, whatever. But it can be really helpful to get some support and get some input from someone who has helped people like you, who's helped people like your loved one who's suffering so much, and help them find you to be taking care of yourself even as you're trying to take care of that other person and support them. Another thing that I often bring up is that, you know, it's only human when someone we love is suffering and maybe causing us suffering because, you know, they're spiraling out of control with drugs or alcohol, or they're going into rage and maybe being abusive toward us or other people we love. It's hard not to feel pretty desperate about that. And some of what we end up doing just naturally is we really get into the role where we're trying to convince the other person, you got to get help. And you were telling them all the reasons why they got to get help. But this can actually make it harder for the other person, the person you love, to seek help. Because, you know, they have mixed feelings about it, right? There's parts of them that are in denial about, you know, whether they need help or not, and can get very defensive. But, you know, there's parts of them that know they're suffering and they really don't like the fact that they're addicted in this way or that they're yelling at you or your kids and things like that. So there's this, you know, there's these kind of battling parts inside of them. Some feel one way, some feel the other way. And the more somebody else is doing all the talking about why they need to change, actually the harder it makes it for them to identify with those parts of themselves. And there's serious research on this. There's a whole, you know, line of research on what's called motivational interviewing, which shows that if, you know, they have people who are heavy drinkers, and if they went in and met with someone for just an hour, like a therapy kind of person, the more that therapist talked about the reasons why they should be changing, more they were drinking 9 months to a year later.
Wow.
So, you know, we get desperate and we think we got to convince this person, we got to, quote, break through their denial. But often what we're doing is we're getting them to dig in their heels in their denial, because we're the one who's doing all the talking about why they need to change. And the parts of them that feel like they need to change are harder for them to connect to, because they feel on the defensive because you're the one doing all that. And so So there's a lot of, you know, interesting work, and I'm trying to think of what the name of this book is. Beyond Addiction, How Science and Kindness Help People Change. It's a really wonderful book, and it spells out this kind of stuff that I was just saying here. It's called A Guide for Families, and it's all about how we can support and help the people we love change and deal with their addiction, and how we can avoid these understandable traps of wanting to push them and convince them, which actually can only make it harder for them to change. And it's got lots of, you know, exercises you can do and handouts and all kinds of stuff. It's a really, really amazing book.
Oh, excellent. That sounds like a fantastic resource.
And it's written for, you know, addiction, but it's about helping people change, you know, who are stuck in any kind of rut or behavior. Addiction just being one of the more extreme forms of that. Mm-hmm. But people who are, you know, really lost in their depression or in their anxiety symptoms and things like that, in some ways they're still struggling with similar things. They're trying to escape from their suffering, and they're seeking to escape from it in ways that obviously aren't fixing it.
Right.
And it's very natural for us to want to point that out to them and push them to do this, and you got to stop doing that, but that can actually make it harder for the person.
That makes sense. That really makes sense. You mentioned earlier the Super Bowl and the campaign surrounding the Super Bowl. It's also the number one event in America for human trafficking. It's amazing how many hundreds of thousands of women and girls are being essentially sold into modern slavery and brought to the Super Bowl area. And I think that kind of coincides with the masculine gender socialization. So they're feeding that with this supply and demand situation. And so people who are being trafficked, they have obviously repeated trauma. And you mentioned in some of your work that repeated trauma often leads to dissociation. So can you tell me a little bit about what that means and how that happens?
Dissociation is a response that the human brain can have to overwhelming trauma, to horrible things that you can't physically escape. You know, someone is literally holding you prisoner, mm-hmm. Which is what we see in human trafficking. As you said, people are literally enslaved and held prisoner, and their lives are threatened. And so when you can't physically escape, sometimes your brain, your mind, tries to escape in other ways by disconnecting yourself from the horrible feelings and emotions, from the horrible reality of it all. And this is actually something that I've done research on in terms of the brain aspects of it. You know, there's areas of our brain that allow us to know what it feels like to be in our body. You know, people who do mindfulness and yoga, you know, those areas of the brain, research is showing they get bigger and they work better because people are tuning into their body. And this is an important part of healing from trauma, is to be able to tolerate and accept and transform those body experiences. But if you're stuck in a situation where you can't get out, where you're repeatedly abused, where you're enslaved, where you're just caught in a home where it's just a hellish environment, there's, you know, genetic contributions as well, but a fair number of people who are in these chronic trauma situations, they will survive it and cope with it by dissociating. And they literally sort of disconnect, their awareness disconnects from their body and from their emotions, and they are kind of going through the motions of things. And it's a survival strategy, and it, you know, it's a brain-based survival strategy. And people can then, it can become like a habitual way of dealing with all kinds of things. You know, sometimes people may get out of the trafficking situation or escape from that terribly abusive home. And then, you know, they're at work and their boss raises their voice, and the next thing they know, it's 30 minutes later and they spaced out somehow. So it can be, you know, disconnecting from your body, feeling like you're in a dream, like you're in a fog, feeling like you're floating out of your body. It can also be just kind of losing time and just kind of disconnecting so much that, you know, you were on autopilot and a half hour later you're like, wait, what just happened? Where have I been? You know, that's along the more extreme end of the continuum. And the most extreme is when people suffer from what used to be called multiple personality disorder, which is now called dissociative identity disorder, mm-hmm. where, you know, they have these different, we all have different parts of us kind of, you know, that come out in different situations. But in dissociative identity disorder, it's very extreme, and people may have completely different personalities that wear different clothing and don't remember, you know, when they're in one state versus another state, and things like that. And so that's the most extreme form that it can take, is this dissociative identity disorder. But it's a human response to overwhelming repeated trauma, to inescapable trauma and abuse, to try to protect us from the awful feelings and sensations and horrible reality of it.
Sure. Now, for people who have used this as a coping mechanism and it has become an automatic coping mechanism, like you were saying, people will lose time or kind of space out in any stressful situation, what's the process by which they can start to overcome that?
Well, so this goes back to what I was saying about, you know, good stage-oriented trauma treatment. Mm-hmm. Dealing with dissociation is part of the first stage of treatment. So you are helping people, you are getting help to be able to feel safe in your body, to be grounded in your body without it freaking you out, and coming up with other strategies for dealing with painful memories, painful emotions, scary things, upsetting experiences in your body, so that you don't need to just check out and escape anymore in a dissociative way. Now, you may remain, you know, you may have a vulnerability to doing it for a long time, maybe even the rest of your life, but you can condition your brain to have new strategies and new tactics for dealing with bad feelings that don't lead you to disconnect from your body. And so, you know, some people are, you know, there's a colleague of mine, David Emerson, who's developed this trauma-informed yoga. You know, sometimes, you know, if you go to a yoga class, I mean, yoga can be wonderful, right? But a lot of yoga is someone at the front of the room telling you what to do with your body. Do this, do that. Okay, now do this, do this posture. Trauma-informed yoga is very gentle, it's very slow, and it's not about telling you what to do with your body. It's giving you the opportunity to tune into your body in small ways that work for you and more over time as it works for you, so that you can actually become safely embodied, to feel what it's like to feel things in your body, including sadness or fear, without it being a terribly scary thing. And so it's a very gentle form of yoga that totally understands that people are struggling with trauma, they're struggling with dissociation, and by doing these trauma-informed yoga practices in a way that you get to choose what you do with your body, that's the whole point of it. Not someone telling you what to do, but giving you opportunities to choose different ways of tuning into your body and making choices about what you want to do with your body based on how your body feels. That can be very healing, and they're doing research, and they've got a randomized controlled trial published on that, and it totally makes sense in terms of how the brain and the body work. So trauma-informed yoga, not just any old yoga, but trauma-informed yoga can be very helpful for people who are constantly automatically fleeing from their embodied experience through dissociation. It can help them become safely embodied.
So if someone wants to try that that type of yoga, how can they learn the techniques?
He's written a couple books on it. So one is called Overcoming Trauma Through Yoga, written by David Emerson and Elizabeth Hopper, no relation to me, though I know her and appreciate her. And so that's a book, you know, it's on Amazon, it's in paperback, it's not that expensive. If you look up, he now, because other people are coming out with what they call trauma-informed yoga too, not all of it, which is so great, he calls his trauma center trauma-sensitive yoga. So the trauma center is a place in Boston, Massachusetts. A guy named Bessel van der Kolk, a very famous trauma psychiatrist, who's written this wonderful book called The Body Keeps the Score, one of the best-selling psychiatry books on Amazon these days, a colleague of mine. So the trauma center is where this trauma-sensitive yoga that Dave Emerson does was born. And so if you Google trauma center, trauma sensitive yoga, you know, up it will come. And he's training people around the world and around the country. There's people that they can connect you up to, maybe in your community, who have the ability to teach you this. And then there's also that book, which is more of kind of a self-help book that you can use on your own. There's therapists who are learning how to integrate this into their treatment of traumatized people. That's the second book, is for therapists.
Excellent. You have a piece called Mindfulness and Kindness, Inner Sources of Freedom and Happiness. So what can people do intellectually, emotionally, to tap into those same kinds of things?
Well, you know, mindfulness isn't an intellectual thing. It's about your awareness and your attention. And mindfulness is actually a very embodied thing. You know, in terms of cognitive things, there's traditions of cognitive therapy that help people deal with the thoughts they have, the self-blaming thoughts, the thoughts of, you know, where you beat up on yourself, the catastrophizing thoughts. So there's definitely cognitive behavioral therapy methods for dealing with those sorts of things. So I guess I would say that, you know, people may find it a little scary to think, oh, why is he talking about this body stuff? The reality is, if you want to heal, the body's part of that. And I don't say that to, like, try and, you know, I don't want to push anybody to do yoga or any sort of body stuff that they're not comfortable with. But any good therapy, even cognitive behavioral therapy these days, which has a lot, has, you know, long tradition of, you know, scientifically supported research, that's integrating in more and more of mindfulness and mindfulness of the body, because emotions are things that happen in our bodies. They have thoughts that go with them, but they're mostly, you know, body sensations and motivations that we have to do things with our bodies.
And it seems that we turn our negative emotions inward, and so inward would go into our body. So that mind-body connection makes perfect sense.
Yeah, and whatever we're doing with our emotions, there's always a bodily component.
Mm-hmm. It's so amazing that everything that we're learning and all of the research that's being done. I applaud you for all that you're doing to try to help trauma victims and really educate people about what's going on and the responses that our bodies have and how they can overcome it. Is there anything you want to leave the audience with? Any thoughts or ideas or information you feel they should know?
Yeah, just that there are people who understand what you're going through and how hard it can be to reach out for help and how scary that can be, and who understand that maybe you've sought therapy before and it wasn't so helpful. But there are people who understand trauma and who understand how to help people through it. And so you want to look for people who understand what I've been talking about, like good stage-oriented trauma treatment, who are going to help you. They're not going to tell you things to do. It's not like some doctor, do this, do that. They're not going to prescribe things for you. They're going to work with you to help you tap into your own power over the healing process. And really, that's what good trauma therapy is. It's a collaborative effort where the therapist is supporting you and you are calling the shots. You know, you're drawing on their expertise, but you are calling the shots and you are not just delving into the scary stuff. You're moving through a process of feeling safer in your body, feeling able to deal with those bad thoughts and memories, getting those skills of how to deal with these unwanted symptoms and things like that. And then only when you're ready to delve into those really more difficult things. And only if you choose. You know, some people find that, you know, when they, you know, get in shape and do physical exercise and they maybe try out some of this gentle yoga, things like that, and feel safer in their body, and they get the skills for dealing with these unwanted feelings and addictive impulses and things like that, that their life gets so much better that they decide, yeah, you know what, I don't want to deal with those trauma memories anymore. And that's different than just trying to escape from them and based on fear and in ways that are harmful to you. That's a, you know, that's an adult informed choice, like, well, you know what, maybe I got to finish this last semester of school, or you know what, my kids are still, you know, a big responsibility for me right now at this age. And, you know, maybe I'll just wait to delve into some of that stuff till later. And that's perfectly acceptable. But just being able to befriend your body and be able to get the skills to deal with these unwanted emotions and sensations and stuff like that in healthy ways, that can be, you know, incredibly healing thing. And there are more and more people around this country who get it and know how to help you and are not just going to give you some drugs and sort of tell you what to do.
Excellent. I am so glad that I came across that Washington Post piece that you wrote, because I think that you have just provided some really, really valuable information for my audience, and I have a feeling that people who are listening are going to share this, because there are so many people that are connected to people who are suffering or who are suffering. It's hard for people to talk about, and it's hard for people to think about. So I think that this is really a universal problem. And so kudos to you for all of the work you're doing. And Jim Hopper, thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It was really nice to talk to you.
This is the 50th episode of The Authentic Woman. So thanks to everyone who's listening to the show tonight. And the podcast will be available indefinitely on iTunes. And until next time, this is Shannon Fisher.